Hello and welcome back to another exciting episode of Online With You. I'm Jessica.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alexis.
And today we are covering the second part of Grit, which is our book for this semester. We'll be talking about chapters
6 and 7.
Yes, which are about interest and practice.
So this is really getting into the meat of it, where start like the application of these concepts that we covered in the first bit. In the first episode, we talked about how important grit is and how it can act as an indicator for various types of success. But now we're getting into the whys and the hows. So in regards to interest, it starts off with when I was reading through this chapter, I really had this image of the passions versus practicality debate. This is something that came up in my master's program when I was doing my advising master's. Career advisors ask the question, you know, should you follow one of your passions, something that you feel very strongly about, or should you follow something more practical? And I mean, if you actually look at like Mike Rowe with the Dirty Jobs crowd and stuff like that, he's all for practicality. I'll bring him up again a little bit later, but Angela Duckworth here advocates that you follow your passion.
Yes, yeah, so I actually like, so she talks about two people in this chapter. One of them is Mark Vetri, so we'll start with him. So he, growing up, wanted to be a musician and didn't really pan out.
Yeah, didn't pan out is a good word for it.
Yeah, so I think he was working at, I think it was a restaurant, and then on weekends or in the evenings, he would play, if I remember right.
He was working as a busboy, I think.
Yeah, that's what it was. Anyways, I remember she said she talked with him and she's like, well, you know, how'd you get into cooking? Because that's ultimately what he became. He's like, I think
world-class
a Michelin
chef.
Yeah, super well known. And he's like, well, I don't know. Let me go find it. Actually, I think I'm confusing the two stories. I think I'm thinking of Jane.
Well, he was working at the restaurant. He just found himself working there more and more. And he worked up from busboy to other jobs, other positions, and got into the kitchen and just discovered this wonderful place that he just fell in love with and decided to pursue that even further. And that's a big part of what Angela talks about, is that passions are not a one and done thing. I think she referenced Julia Childs, the famous chef, that did have kind of an experience where she realized that this French cooking could be so wonderful and wanted to bring that to others. But it wasn't like that was her, that kind of ignited her passion for French cooking, but she always had a passion. I mean, she'd worked up this passion of cooking. And so it's not something that's just a single revelation in a moment, but a passion is the result of work and exposure.
Yeah, for sure. And I was confusing the two stories. So Jane, she was an artist, and then we decided it was lupus, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And she couldn't do art anymore, and it was really hard for her, but she decided, you know, she's going to start this program for, I think, ultimately to help, you know, prevent graffiti, but it's an art program for people to get exposed or whatever. And Jane said, you know, I couldn't do art, but I could still do something that was creative. So I think, you know, going back to what Angela Duckworth was saying, you know, find your passion and how do you relate that to students? It's like, yes, you should find something practical, but you should also look at what makes you passionate, what makes you interested in things, because it may not be the thing that you think it is. For example, Mark, he wanted to go into music, but he ultimately fell in love with cooking. And it's another creative outlet, but it was not the actual music that he was liking. It was the creativity he liked, if that makes sense.
His passion was creativity, and then the medium was just music or food.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of time we let people around us talk about what's more practical and like convince us into not pursuing passions. Yesterday I was in a entrepreneurial class, and the head of Kodiak Cakes came, Joe Clark, and he has owned this now for 35 years, and it started off with his brother, all of these things, and but there were so many obstacles. Like, the recession was really huge for his company, trying to figure out how to like market a pancake mix like in of itself is really hard. And I think that if he had allowed people to tell him like, that's not for you, right, like that isn't practical, you're good enough to be able to go and work in other fields, go do that instead, then he wouldn't be the huge success he is now today. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back into like why grit and perseverance is so important, and that's why grit is like passion and perseverance, right?
Yeah, I kept thinking about your wife.
Oh,
and her experience with that math teacher. Like, the whole time I was reading, I was like, this just reminds me of Charity.
For recap on that, she had a math. She wanted to go into algebra in junior high or high school, And the teacher told her she was too dumb to. She was too dumb for that level of math. And my wife said, basically, to heck with you, I'm going to prove you wrong. And she went through her AP calculus series, started in engineering, and didn't get out of engineering because of the math, got out because of the physics. We will not discuss the problems with those kinds of professors. But, I mean, she finished her differential equations and everything else. That professor was so disconcerned with students that I don't think he'd do anything that a student would do.
All right, I think we're safe.
I don't think he's here anymore either.
All right, even better.
So it's a matter of that persistence and understanding that, again, that this is something that's developed. You can't just... She talked about this, about students that are like... or students that come to her and say, I've got so many interests I don't know what to pursue. And she's like, well, you've got lots of things that you are vaguely familiar with. Try some of them and get further into them than just a passing fancy, and that's how you'll discover your passion. You won't find your passion just glancing around the landscape. You got to start digging holes.
Yeah, Mark Vetri said that growing up, he would always be in his, I think it was his grandma, they'd go over every weekend and he would just cook with her. So he had a lot of exposure. He had a lot of time to develop, the skills and the interest in cooking in order to become, who he is today, a celebrated chef. So.
Yeah. My own father actually has a great example where he originally started going to school in pre-med technologies. So he was a biology major, and he had an opportunity to work in an office that was run by, I believe it was like the former CEO of IBM would have been 70s. And he just saw what this office, like the office environment. And when he returned to school from that experience, he changed his major to business and never looked back. I mean, and a couple of decades ago told me that he was basically in his dream job. And it was a job that he had no clue existed when he was in college. So even after finding this great passion in business, he still dug deeper to find even more of the actual occupation he ended up loving and enjoying and is still doing, even after further digging into that.
Yeah, and I think we could look at Angela Duckworth. She graduated in neurobiology. That was her undergrad, I think. And mm-hmm. then she worked as a marketing consultant with, I don't remember the company. And then she got her MBA.
Big market research company.
Yeah. And then she got her PhD. And now she's she's researching grit. I mean, it was a long journey, but she stuck with it. But she, as with each of the things that she did, she would taught in the middle school for a while. Mm-hmm. But with each of those things, she was able to define her purpose, her overall overarching life philosophy that she mentioned from the other guy.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, we get deeper into the purpose versus job versus career versus calling, I think, is what it is. That's going to be in chapter 8, I think.
Yes.
Yep. So yeah, we'll dive deeper into that. I do want to swing back to Mark Rowe, because in his discussions about choosing practicality, it's interesting because he says, if you do what you're good at, you'll come to like it more and more. So even his own arguments about choosing practicality are about diving deeper into it and finding your place within that. It's not just I can do this, or this is a good choice, even if I hate it. It's this is something that I can do and do it well enough. I mean, and as you strive to do it well enough, you'll come to like it. And in some ways, that's almost like Angela's father, who went into chemistry because the family textile business needed a chemist.
Yeah.
There were 5 sons. They needed 5 different topics. He became the chemist. And it was a thing that he won awards in, and he was happy in doing. But the reason he chose it was over practicality. So, I mean, really, when it comes to passion or practicality, the answer is choose something that as you get further into it, you come to really love.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I love that analysis of making sure that you find something that you grow deeper and deeper affinity for throughout. And as a college student, a question that I kind of had throughout reading this chapter was, how do you balance then grit and sticking with things and that persevering, right? And interest, being able to change gears like your dad, or even your own career, Dan, changing gears when something hits you and you find that interest.
I'm going to tell you now, even as a college graduate, I still struggle with that. So just prepare for that. Just know it never ends, because then you're going to be working. Yeah. You're like, how do I balance all of these things?
Well, I mean, but this is valid.
I'm not good at, you know, refining my interests, you know.
You brought up my own career experience. And yeah, I originally wanted to go into teaching. And I think this was what we talked about in our notes session. I originally wanted to go into teaching and ended up in student services because I realized that what I really loved was working with students and just helping individual students grow. And as an advisor, I was able to do that, and I'm still able to do that now. In fact, somebody asked if I was recently going to take one of the director positions, Anka's position that opened up, and I was like, I don't know. I think I still like working with students too much. Give me 5 or 6 years to get annoyed with students, and then I'll go into that position.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because the decision to start applying for advisor jobs came about almost through practicality. I'd had an opportunity to work for 2 years as an advisor, but I, you know, as I was approaching my senior year, I'd been my wife and I had gotten married at the beginning of my senior year, and I remember we were driving to go visit family or something like that, and graduation was coming up really soon, and my wife's like, you know, so what are the plans after you graduate? Where are you going to start looking? You know, are we looking at grad school? Are we looking at what kind of jobs and stuff? And I was like, you know, I can do advising and I like it. It's not teaching, but you know, I really think I like that. And that's what got me started to applying for student services jobs. So it was this very much a combination of passion working with students and practicality on, I'm going to need a job faster. And this is probably going to be better than this. I can find this faster than I can find a teaching job because I don't have a license right now.
Yeah. And that's something I really loved about Jane's story as well, actually, that I think that passion isn't necessarily your career, right? Like, very rarely is your passion a job, but I think that it's like the underlying thing that you love, right? Like, Jane loved creativity and being able to do that, and I think that you found that you loved like that education factor and being able to like help people in some kind of like education forum, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that was teaching or as an advisor. And so I think that like finding an interest doesn't necessarily have to be like directly associated to a career. It can be, I am passionate about people. I'm passionate about connection. I'm passionate about
It's rare that your passion will have a job title directly associated with it.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. Now, the great thing is you can find jobs that let you do that passion and you can be passionate about your job, but you're not going to find a job title that says, you know, chief passionate student interest person, you know.
Yeah. That'd be kind of awesome.
Yeah, your job title is not going to be a description of your passion.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, you're going to have to like create the passion within your career.
Yeah.
So career is more of the means to an end.
Yeah. Well, and I think this gets back to what we were looking at in chapter 8 about job versus career versus calling. Because mm-hmm. Let's face it, some people, their job, their calling is their passion. Like what they do for work, they're truly passionate about it. I mean, I think Angela Duckworth is a prime example of this. Mm-hmm. $10 says that she lives, breathes, and eats grit. That sounds funny, but you know.
Doesn't sound
well, I guess a lot of
though.
People in the South eat grits too, you know, but that's anyway.
Yeah.
But it's passion is a constantly evolving and strengthening process that you have to work on and refine. And with that in mind, I think that's a great segue into chapter 7, where we talk about practice. And I thought this was such a marvelous chapter because it gets into, okay, now that we've discovered our passion, how do we go about taking it to the next level? And as I was reading this section, I came across something that my grandmother said. Everyone has probably heard the phrase, practice makes perfect. Mm-hmm. And with grandma, that's not the phrase. With grandma, the phrase is perfect practice makes perfect. Because let's face it, if you do the same thing 20 times over, if you sit down to a piano and plink away for 20 minutes, you're not going to get any better. Then it doesn't matter what's your song you're playing or whatever, you're not going to get any better at it. But if you sit down and focus on what you're doing, and you know, focus on, okay, I'm going to get the timing right on this, I'm going to get the notes right, I'm going to practice my finger exercises, so on and so forth, that's what's going to improve you. And Angela Duckworth brings this up. She refers to it as deliberate practice.
Yeah.
And so once I hit that phrase, deliberate practice, I immediately thought, oh, this is perfect practice. This is perfect practice makes perfect.
Can I just say I felt so called out when you're like, oh, you can't just sit down at a piano and expect to just get better just by playing through the piece. I would do that.
Well, so would I. So would I. In fact, I'm willing to bet there isn't a musician out there that hasn't done that at one point or another. Because let's face it, many people don't like practice. Most people don't like practice. Does anybody really like practicing?
Yeah,
especially when you suck at it.
Yeah. Especially at first, right? Yeah. Like that part where you suck at it, right? Like it feels so overwhelming because you're just not at the point that you want to be at. And like you have potentially an interest like behind it, hopefully, right? But I think that's probably a big reason why a lot of kids like give up on piano, because they don't have like that interest like facilitating them wanting to practice, right? And if you don't really want to do the thing you're doing and spending so much time, I think that that's when deliberate practice becomes really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, and they get into this, or I mean, this is towards the end of the chapter, they talk about how the difference between deliberate practice and flow. Flow being, of course, the concept that it's that when you're in the zone, when you're focused so much and you're just going with it. I mean, this is the movie Soul. You know, flow is the bubbles when they're in the bubbles.
Such a good movie.
But flow is wonderful. Everyone loves flow. All the cylinders are firing at the right time. Everything's going smoothly. You're loving life. And flow is the result of deliberate practice. It is not deliberate practice. You really can't get flow during deliberate practice because of how focused you have to be in deliberate practice and how uncomfortable it can be because you're not there yet. And so she really talks about, okay, so if flow is the fun part, can you have fun while you're practice? And the answer is kind of not really. Practice isn't meant to be fun. However, it is horribly worthwhile. And she cites several different athletes. I'm trying to remember, do we have the names down here? I'm trying to remember the names.
I don't remember the athletes, but she did talk to, so she did all of the studies with the Spelling Bee competitors.
Yes, remember she's talking about the Spelling Bee.
And then she, I think after a couple years, she went back and she investigated this whole deliberate practice and flow. And I found it interesting that she said that students who did more deliberate practice actually rated it as more enjoyable. It doesn't mean they loved it, obviously, but they rated it more enjoyable, probably because they had experienced flow. And from my own experience, my roommate recently got a piano from her parents because they're moving. So I've been able to actually sit down and like practice like more, I almost spoke Spanish there, more often. Because, you know, I only go down to my dad's house where there is a piano I can use, you know, like once a month. But like as I was deliberately practicing a piece that I love and have just kind of muddled through my way, I taught myself so I could play it at a playable level. It felt so rewarding that I was like motivated to do more deliberate practice. So I think that's kind of how the relationship between flow and deliberate practice works.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And I think that we're using this term deliberate practice a lot. And I think that maybe our viewers and listeners don't exactly know what that is. And so she actually goes into the three steps or ways that you have deliberate practice, which is like first learning the science, then you make it a habit, and then you can change the way that you experience it. And I think that your example, Jess, was like perfect right there, right?
Well, thank you.
To like get those three things, right? Like you were able to get the piano, right? Like access the ability to do it, learn more about it, plug away at the learning styles, how you learn so that you could progress, right? You made it a habit more consistently than you were before.
I wouldn't quite call it a habit yet, but it's getting better.
Yeah, like finding some kind of ritual, right? Like being able to, whether that's daily ritual, like you've dedicated time to it. Right. And then that last thing, I loved what you said about how your whole perspective on it's changed and it's become so rewarding. I feel like I had a similar experience with running. And I think a lot of runners.
I'm still not going to do that. I'm saying, go ahead. Tell us about your experience running. You will not hear one
We'll
from
get
me.
Him, Alexis, you one day. We'll get him.
I think a lot of avid runners have the same experience, though, that it's like you start out and you hate it. Nobody likes running at first. It's terrible. You go and it's like, my heart is going to explode. I'm by myself. Like, it's probably cold or really hot, so you're sweating and you're like embarrassed because you're like outside and people are passing you in their cars, and you're thinking, ah, these people are probably just thinking like this crazy runner lady who's outside.
They can't judge. They're not running.
Exactly. My dad always says, what are they running away from?
That's a line question. From a Studio C sketch that's about. Studio C did a great sketch on running and about what are they running from?
Oh, oh yes, I've seen that one. It's a good one.
That's so funny.
It's got shin splints. Take the leg. No.
But yeah, like as I continued, like I made it more of a habit because I knew that I really wanted to work towards this goal. I'm actually going to run a Ragnar this like upcoming summer. And I was training for like a half marathon and everything. So I was like, I really need to start doing this, right? And so I dedicated time to make sure I started doing that. And now I love it. It's so fun. And like, I know that obviously there's physiological stuff that goes into that of how like certain hormones are released when you're exercising that make you like happier and stuff. But like now I can't wait to go out and run. And I think that it's because I did that deliberate practice even when I didn't like it at first, even like what we were talking about, yeah. When you sucked at first, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and that reminds me, so, you know, Angela Duckworth, you know, she gave her own little anecdote of, you know, running and not progressing.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for people to realize you need to set realistic expectations for each step of your journey, because a lot of people probably quit running or probably quit learning instruments because they think, oh, I'm only going to practice like a few minutes every day, a couple days a week, and then I'm just going to become like some really great prodigy. And that's not the case. Like,
yeah,
you need to know that it's dedication.
Well, yeah,
for not just that,
days
but
and months and years.
When she talked about running, it reminded me of a conversation I overheard. Where this guy was talking about his own experience with running. And so I thought I love this because it's you know, two witness verification here. And the guy was saying that he was talking to a running coach and saying, I've been running now for like 6 months or however long, and I'm not getting any faster, you know? And the coach said, well, have you tried? Like, have you actively started running faster?
Yeah.
And, I mean, and that was kind of what Angela's thing was, like, I'm not getting any faster at running. And the coach was like, well, have you tried to improve?
Yeah.
And the guy was like, wow, in order to run faster, you have to run faster.
What a novel idea.
But just how easy it is to fall in the trap of, I'm doing my practice, I'm going through my routine or whatever, but if you don't set goals to stretch yourself, you're not going to make it. And and I'm already going back. I said you'd never hear a running story from me, but here is one. It's not quite a running story. It's a walking / jogging story. And so a little while ago, about a year ago, I was looking to lose some weight. And so we snatched up a treadmill from my sister-in-law. They didn't need it, so we grabbed it. And I said, okay, well, you know, I hooked up a TV in front of it so I could watch a show while I'm doing this. And I started just, I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna walk for 45 minutes. But I wanted it to be a productive 45 minutes, right? So I'd have a warm-up period. And then rather than increase the speed, I would jack the elevation. And after doing this for a little while, I realized that I wasn't getting any benefit. I wasn't getting the same heart rate as I was before and stuff like that. And so I started increasing the speed on it. And I was like, you know, if I keep this up, I'm going to end up jogging at some point.
Heaven forbid.
And, yeah. Yes, so I gotta take a few steps back. Can't progress too fast.
Yeah. And actually, it was shortly after that I stopped. But that's because due to home renovations, the treadmill ended up in a room that it's not readily accessible. So, but I'm excited because
the basement is finished.
The basement will be finished. We're getting carpet on the 17th, so I'm excited about that.
Then there will be no excuses, Dan.
Yeah, and to be honest, I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. I'm actually looking forward to it.
Because messages.
That's because my weight loss today? Really plateaued and had a problem. And I'm like, I need to get back. I need to get moving again. And so I need to get back to this. So I've got, there's all kinds of, there's a whole layer and a whole onion's worth of goals here associated with this. But I remember coming to the realization, I'm going to have to, you know, in order to continue getting benefit from this, I'm going to have to keep increasing that speed. And that means I'm going to run. Now, if I'm going to apply the three steps about learn the science, make it a habit, and change the way I experience it, one of the reasons why I don't like running is because it hurts. I know that's partially due to the fact that I've got horrible technique. And so I need to learn the science and improve my technique. I need to do the fundamentals. I need to get into the nitty gritty and figure out the best way for me to run.
Yeah.
And then of course, making it a habit. She talks about daily rituals and she cites several people about, it was several writers that, you know, wake up at the same time, go through, you know, do their workout or whatever, have breakfast, and then where they go to write. They, and it's funny because as we were discussing this part, it was exactly what we tell people when it comes to a study routine, right? Mm-hmm. You know, study in the same place every day, you know, make it a habit, those sort of thing.
So and make it yours.
Yeah, make it yours. Working with time management and location management, all that sort of thing. And then, of course, this changed the way you experience it. When it comes to running, as I said, I probably will never be the sort of person that goes jogging outside. If I'm going to run, it'll probably be in the comfort of my own home, and I'll probably have a show on because that keeps me very entertained while my body is suffering. Right?
Yeah, it distracts from the pain.
Exactly. I've known people that will do stationary bike or a come and bike while playing a video game, so they're on controller or whatever.
Yeah.
I did a Republican bike, and I'd read a book. Like, I'd actually sit there with my book while doing a Republican bicycle.
I saw something like that at the gym the other day.
Yeah. I mean, so changing things up and making it varied, maybe there will come a point while I run outside because that's how I need to change it up at that moment. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is the whole part of deliberate practice. It's not stagnant. It's not static. You have to keep on developing it. You have to keep on working on it, and you have to keep on working on yourself.
Well, this has been very exciting. These are really interesting chapters, and we're excited to talk about the other two, which are escaping me right now. We're discussing those next month though. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, join us in on the conversation, hit us up on the social medias. Or through email. We check that regularly as well. We would love to hear what your thoughts are and, you know, your own experience with developing grit.
Yeah, so the email address is online at usu.edu. We'd love to hear from you on that. And we will see you online.
Bye.
Thank you.